There's nothing like it. A couple practical things for those arriving today. I've been emphasizing relaxation this session. I think it's a real important support for our practice. So in that spirit, and because we're kind of a small group and an experienced group, that the afternoon periods, we have these two sets of two periods, that if people feel like it would be helpful for their practice, you know, discerning this for yourself in your own experience, to get up, like if you're feeling sleepy, get up and walk during zazen. And even in the middle of a period, if you do it very quietly and carefully, or lie down or stand on your head, or you can experiment, a little bit more experimental than the strict form, no matter what. Which sometimes, I think there's great benefits of that, and it is part of our style, is whatever's happening, you just do it. And I think there's value to that, and I think there's value to finding our own way, not wasting time in zazen. I've spoken of how my confession that I feel like I've wasted a lot of time in my own zazen over the many years. And I don't know if I necessarily regret it. It's just what happened. But more and more I feel like I'd rather not. And part of this is, in the past, it's my own unclarity about zazen and just sitting. So we've emphasized so far this practice period, this sesshin, shamatha, calm abiding, and being particularly very clear about the object of meditation. I think this is where I sometimes wasted time. Is just be here. No real object. We hear things like that that are, I think, very similar to the actual practice. But depending on how we understand it, it's a kind of a sort of a, there's an undercurrent of just commentary running along, whatever. Relaxing, good for relaxation, but in the end, maybe not that ultimately so helpful. So being clear about the object, the breath is an excellent one in our tradition. I keep coming back to, and then there's many, many objects can be used, but I think the breath is an excellent one, especially in our tradition, and also especially in our tradition, the field, the wide field of experience as object for cultivating shamatha, or calming the mind. All the senses are open, but we're not so much attending to the specific sounds and sensations and sights. That's maybe possible too, but I also offer this possibility of the field, the wider field of nowness, which is like there's sounds happening there and there's sensations here, but the object is not so much veering from the sound to the sensation, but the focus of the object is the overall sense of the cutting edge of the moment, the crest of the breaking wave of the moment, riding that now, utterly present. And it's the mind, awareness is attending to that specific but wide and spacious object. Another way, very similar, what Nanette mentioned one way, I think is very similar, about the silence, the field of experience we call silence that includes sound. I think that's her creative way of looking at that. I think very similar, slightly different nuance maybe, but similar effect, as I understand it. Another one to throw into the mix, the wide field of experience in the moment called space or spaciousness. Almost again like a kind of a sense of physical space all around us, either in front, I've heard in different instructions, so you can play with these, the space in front of you with your eyes open, as Dogen mentioned, they are during Zazen, the actual physical space, but with as an object, or 360 degrees, spherical even, up and down, the space all around, in the moment. So those are some creative things you might not have ever tried. As an object, a wide object. Wide object is kind of nice because the mind becomes more spacious and possibly more relaxed. But also the wider the object, the easier to lose it. So we have the mindfulness attending to the object. We have the relaxation is the bottom line, like always keep checking in. If we're concentrating too hard, we may, the body and breath and mind may not be relaxed, first of all, and throughout. Deep relaxation, settledness, and then the quality of vigilance or diligence, whose function as the kind of monitor of the situation. Diligence's function is to just, as one commentary defines it, its function is to just check to see that the mindfulness hasn't forgotten the object. Mindfulness can also be translated as remembering. So the mind is just remembering to stay with the breath or the wide field of experience, and the diligence is like checking, have you lost it? And it seems that the wider the object, the more diligence may be required, and the more diligence is working, the more relaxation really has to be also remembered. So these three working together harmoniously is the cultivating shamatha, calm abiding. And I've recently been listening to talks of Alan Wallace and really, really appreciating him as a amazing teacher and yogi, and you know, he must have like 20 or 30 books out now, all on the nuances of meditation and also physics and science. And he was a Tibetan monk for 15 years or so, and then he kind of came back into a more like mainstream life so that he could really work with the scientists and explore more areas. So I kind of feel like his specialty thing is shamatha. And in the, listening to his talks, I feel like he might be like the number one Western expert on shamatha practice and how to express it and all the different variations of it. And does lots of long shamatha retreats with people. So he also greatly emphasizes relaxation, and he also, there's some guided meditations which I've tried going along with and find very helpful. And I offer this, some of these things that are helpful, and I with a little warning that I'm warning you before I say them, that this might sound a little scary, or it might sound a little bit like, this sounds a little different from how we usually talk about meditation. So I think depending on where we're at, you might feel like this sounds like too much, but some of the phrases he uses for really working on shamatha deeply with a strong foundation of relaxation, and I would also add in here a strong foundation of kindness and compassion towards ourselves and others. That's kind of like bottom line. If we get confused or upset or self-judgmental or other judgmental, or even everything's going really well, still, this is like our theme for the year, kindness and compassion. So with this in mind, he, I think emphasizing the vigilance quality, once you're decided on the object, you're committed to the object, and you're, then he says, like, if a thought arises, which it will, immediately release it. Maybe that doesn't sound that strong, but you know, immediately, like the vigilance is watching. There comes this conceptual thought just emerging, like without like a second's delay. That if that monitor is really alert, it's just like release. And I think release is a nice word, not like obliterate it, cut it out, smash it, crush it. Just release it. And in fact, thoughts are releasing themselves all the time, unless we pick them up and play with them, which we love to do. Thought arises, immediately release it. I just find that really helpful and very hard to do because I love thoughts. But it's very, I really appreciate that instruction. I think that's one thing for me. I wouldn't have wasted so many years if I was like, I'm really committed to immediately releasing conceptual thoughts. Because we hear things like, well, you know, you want to have an easy spaciousness and very relaxed. We know that. And don't be too hard on ourselves. So I think I gave a lot of leeway to conceptual thought. Maybe we all do, but in Sashin especially, we can maybe really get down to this point. There's nothing we have to think about. And the other phrase he uses is that I thought is maybe too intense for some people, but it works for me, is have zero tolerance for the commentator of discursive thought. Have zero tolerance. Because our practice is all about tolerance and acceptance and patience. But in this case, if we're really diligently cultivating shamatha, there's this one thing we have zero tolerance for, which is the conceptual commentator, or the commentator of discursive thought. And that's, again, quite hard to have zero tolerance and remembering the underlying basis of total kindness and compassion to ourself, especially here, and total relaxation. And so in that context, maybe then we can hear a phrase like that. I've been working with it in a way that I don't feel like it's a nasty, police state regime, to say zero tolerance, I feel like it's very refreshing. Okay, or it's actually, and very kind to myself, I feel like. Okay, Kokyo, you've been running these stories for a while now. It's time for that, for the monitor of vigilance to stand up and say, okay, zero tolerance. Very helpful. I mean, there's an effect of this, and the effect is very joyful, actually. So it's strong language. For me, sometimes on the fourth day of Sesshin, it works well. So immediately release any conceptual thought and have zero tolerance for maybe the same thing, but particularly the commentator that's kind of like really running the discursive thoughts. You know, my commentators and discursive thoughts, I notice in Sesshin, maybe like 98%, at least this Sesshin, maybe most of them, is like about the Sesshin and about the Dharma talks particularly. So it's kind of nice to talk about shamatha, because I'm like, if I'm thinking about anything, it's about like the specific details of shamatha. And but I have to confess, it's a total distraction. Not total. Well, yeah, okay, I'll say total. It's like, it's a little. There's a fine line between checking on the, you know, reviewing the methods, which we do need to do, to remember, and then kind of like reviewing them again and again too much, and like, okay, it's like this and like this, and then, you know, one thing that Alan Wallace actually says is, just practice shamatha without even vipassana. There's just myriad benefits, and one of them is like incredible creativity. So that's maybe a disadvantage in some ways, because this creative part of my mind is like, these just, you know, thoughts arise like, oh man, I gotta like remember this one for the next talk. And so, yeah, sometimes they seem pretty good at the time. Almost everything starts to seem pretty good when you're getting really cooking in this. Any thought seems around this kind of stuff. And another maybe like anxiety that comes up a little bit for me to confess to is giving these talks about this topic, because I feel like, if I'm going to talk about this, I really have to be doing it. And then there's this like added pressure. Like, it's not authentic if I'm just saying, have zero tolerance, but then like, well, I have a lot of tolerance for the stories. I'll let some run. So I do let some run, but I'm really to practice some of the things I'm suggesting is sometimes like, the period just before the Dharma talk, this last period of Zazen, feeling a little bit of like, oh, you know, maybe the period before I wasn't that on the ball. And so here comes the talk, like, Kokyo, get it together. I think one kind of loose translation that I think Alan Wallace used for samadhi is getting it together. having it all really together, like everything. So and in a way that spur was actually in a way quite helpful. It's like I could get more and more anxious about it right after the talk, or I could really like just stop and do the practice. It maybe was ended up being my favorite period so far of the Sesshin. Was the last one. So, and more too, I feel like this Sesshin is as like the laboratory. I had the image in Zazen of like the, you know, the laboratory technician with the notepad and the white jacket, you know, kind of like taking notes on what's going on, checking in, what was it? It was like a, I had this image of like, there's the one who's sort of that checking on, it's a little bit like the monitor of vigilance, but it's maybe another one in here who's sort of like, not right in the moment of just dropping into it, but like coming out of it a little bit and taking some notes and going back in. And that one is like, I thought, and I kind of like even sort of dressed him up in a white coat, just like, cause I brought up that image the other day, it kind of happened, like there he is. And like, and how ridiculous, and like, so then like another laboratory technician in a white coat, like peeked around the corner and looked at him and took notes on him. And I almost laughed out loud during Zazen. I'm like, and I had this image, you know, these are just images for actually how it works, and then I'm sort of elaborating on the images in order to put them into words to talk about. And that's part of the distraction. But it's a little bit like that lab technician is almost just like peeking through a crack in the door. And it not, again, not really during the moment of shamatha, but like you kind of slip out of it a little, like a little bit of discursivity comes in, and there's, okay, here's a chance for, because the technician's a little bit discursive, but he has to be so gentle to kind of just peek through a crack in the door, take a few notes, what I'm saying is like, kind of like checking how, what's happening here, how it's working, and like what is working, what isn't working, kind of like that kind of notes. That, and I see how, okay, as I slip out of it, that's how it was entered, and now we can get more and more refined how to enter, something like that. So, shamatha, calm abiding, provides this like really strong stability and clarity as this basis for vipassana, which is like a blade to cut through to the source of mind. Maybe it's like shamatha is like the jig for the table saw or something like that. It's like a stable foundation, keeping the wood in alignment, and then vipassana is like the table saw. And so they work together like this. So vipassana in our family style is sometimes spoken of, I propose, as turning the light around, shining back. It's not a discursive kind of shamatha, I mean vipassana, insight, practice, very direct, experiential. And it's like in the Sandhya Nirmochana Sutra, it almost seems like that practice, which we talked about yesterday as the mind attending to the uninterrupted mind, and to the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. The Buddha says that's shamatha practice, and their Tenzin Roshi therefore is talking about it in the shamatha section in the Core with That Sutra. But I feel like this is like almost like a bridge, which is why it's a beautiful shamatha practice, because it's like a bridge, or even I would say from the Zen perspective, it's actually more like it's the union of shamatha and vipassana, because they're not that different, actually. So, our Tenzin Roshi, I started to read some of this yesterday, and practicing the instruction to turn the light around and shine it back, we make a transition from looking at objects and thinking about them to concentrating on the uninterrupted mind, or as the sutra calls it, the mind that can think, that can be thought of by any mind, or the inner stream of the meditating consciousness, or the source of mind, or that aspect of mind that's not thinking, but from which thoughts emerge out of. Therefore, this practice is also called thinking of what doesn't think. Or it's also because it's the place that thoughts come out of, we could also call it thinking of what thinks, of the, but the source of mind from which thoughts emerge, and from in shamatha, from which no thoughts are emerging, but it's the source of the awareness that's attending to the thought-free field of experience. So this transition from looking at objects, an object could be this quite subtle field of nowness or spaciousness all around. But I think this is one thing your lab technician can do that I've been checking out is like, is that really an object? And it feels like, yeah, I can feel like there's an awareness that's intentionally attending to a quite a subtle object. Therefore, there's a subject attending to an object. It's quite subtle, but you can check and you can step out a little bit and look back at that experience and feel how that is so. I think that's valuable to notice. There's a little bit of duality in this. Not much, but compared to our usual mind, right? That's why it's shamatha. So this transition now back to the uninterrupted mind is potentially disorienting. In my experience, Tenzin Roshi says, it can be nauseating. We are not used to looking at something, attending to something, without any way to reflect on it. Because the source of mind that we look back at is not something we're going to see. This is why it's disorienting. We are not attending to just anything, but to a mind that is contemplated by any mind. The mind that is uninterrupted, undisturbed, untouched by images, the mind that no words can reach. This is so unlike our usual way of being, we can feel seasick here. You know, maybe physically or metaphorically. What's more, when we try to get a hold of things, we find ourselves slipping away from the meditation itself back into a conceptual image of it. And I definitely find this experience. Because we're giving ourselves, I feel like I'm giving myself these instructions. Because this is, it's a quite specific practice here. It's not just like sitting and seeing what happens. It's a quite intentional practice, this turning the light around. So there's very gentle and instructions with it, using as little words or thought as possible to kind of steer the direction back. But then to go back and start to fall into this ungraspable spaciousness, and very quickly the mind like wants to get a hold of something. So it just starts conceptualizing it again, like, oh yeah, the source of mind, or something. It just could be quite subtle, actually. Naming it, making some image of it. Oh yeah, it's the light. Yeah, yeah, it's really bright. It can be quite subtle, but all that is conceptualization, which the mind at that point is desperately trying to do. Another thing Alan Wallace says at this point, he's like, if fear arises, because it's a little bit like fear of losing everything we know and are, he says, one thing that helps, somebody was asking him about, well, I feel like I the mind subtly turns away at this point or conceptualizes again because there's some fear of disappearing. And he says, well, just think about sleep. Every night, this happens to us. We basically lose who we are. Our self kind of disappears. We let it go, and we're totally used to that. It's not a big deal whatsoever, right? We like it to let go of ourselves and drop off into ungraspable unconsciousness in a way in that case. So it's not exactly like this is like sleep, right? But it's somewhat related in that it's letting go of ourself. So I thought that was a nice image of like, just think how we're not afraid of sleep. Think of it like that. So the sutra says that in developing concentration, we attend to a non-conceptual object. When the sutra tells us about this, we receive the instruction conceptually, and we use this conceptual instruction to direct our mind to the non-conceptual object, which is the mind contemplated by any mind, the inner stream of the meditating consciousness or the source of awareness, the uninterrupted mind. It's a non-conceptual, uninterrupted mind. Dogen Zenji reports that once he was talking to his teacher, old Buddha Ru Jing, who told him that the practice of the Buddhas and ancestors is to sit in the middle of the world of the suffering of all beings. By sitting with all beings, by opening to their suffering and listening to the cries of the world, there is the birth of what's called Nyūshin in Japanese, which means supple, soft, or flexible mind. So this is like a whole other angle here, just remembering the context of what could seem like kind of a self-obsessed project here. When we get into all the details of it, keep remembering this larger context of sitting in the world of suffering beings, opening, totally open to all of that. This develops this soft, flexible mind. And then Dogen asked his teacher, what is this supple mind? And Ru Jing said, it's the willingness for body and mind to drop off. The willingness for body and mind to drop off is also open to all the suffering beings of the world. This is what I think is being suggested by this sutra and these other great teachers. When you contemplate the undisturbed inner stream of the meditating mind, you're opening to body and mind dropping off. Opening to that, you're opening to the light turning around and shining back onto the mind itself. Dogen says, learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will manifest. As we chanted this morning. What is your original face? It's a face that relinquishes any concept of face. So there's no way to carry any meaning about what your face is. That's your original face. This training in tranquility or calm abiding in this sutra, this Mahayana shamatha, is to open to your face without any concept by which you can understand your face. Learning the backward step, this face manifests. That's one way of talking about this. So that's as one of my root teacher that I have such deep gratitude for his instructions on this over the years. And my other root teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, some of his oral instructions about this same practice, which runs through all these traditions. He's in the Dzogchen tradition, but Yeah, he's talking about turning the light around, shining back. These are some kind of like nuances that I found helpful amongst many other things. So we're looking back, and his instruction is look gently. When you're turning the light around, look very gently. If we don't look at all, if we don't look back at all, we miss it. But if we look too strongly, we go right past it. And I think this is, in playing with this machine, I find this so true. Not doing it at all is like what we're usually doing. Or even in the shamatha, I feel there's a very distinct difference between the shamatha that's just attending to the spacious nowness and this shift back. So not doing that shift, it's a different experience when you do. But if you do it too roughly or strongly, you go past, and past is then you're looking for some source. You're like looking to see something in subtly or grossly, or it's too much effort, and the effort disturbs the relaxed space of shamatha in which this is happening. And I thought of, in Jivamir Samadhi, turning away and touching are both wrong, because it's like a massive fire. I think he's actually talking about this. This massive fire is the source of mind. So turning away, which might be just like, not, I don't want anything to do with it, but just like ignoring it, then we don't feel its warmth. And trying to touch it, which is like get any conceptual hold of it, those are both wrong. Another thing, a way that that is too strong, that we go past it, is if we're looking for a strong confirmation from it. A sign, yeah. Like, oh yeah, like, because we're trying to look for something called the source of mind, and we want some confirmation, like, this is it. But we're so used to confirmation in our own experience coming in a conceptual way that this again could be quite subtle. I think we know the confirmation is not going to be like, hi, I'm your source of mind. But it could be just a little bit like, here it is. It's like this. Even though we know that it's not like this or that.
Great bumper sticker where it said, if you're looking for a sign, this is it.
If you're looking for a sign, this is it. But in this case, the sign will not come like that.
No.
Yeah. And another thing that Sogyal Rinpoche says is like, there is confirmation from this non-dual awareness, but it has to come from the non-dual awareness itself, which is a very subtle point. That if there's the slightest dualistic mind that's like, this is it, that immediately makes it into something. But I think it's beautiful to say there is actually a confirmation from this non-dual awareness. You know it. And if you try to get a hold of that knowing, then it's gone. Like in Zen, they talk about, like, you know whether water's hot or cold, but, if you try to describe what that's like to someone who's never felt temperature or something, it's like, then you're into words and concepts. But, maybe we could say there's qualities that afterwards, you come out of it a little bit, the lab technician can peek through the door very quietly, not during it actually, but even you slip back into shamatha. That's one way to talk about this. Because I think this can happen like this, as you slip out of that, the union of shamatha and vipassana, that's completely non-dual awareness, and you slip back into now you're back at the stage from which you dropped into that. And the stage is still quite present. You still have no tolerance for discursive thought. but you let the lab technician in, like, what was that all about? Or what, you know? Well, that's so fresh. What could you say about it in retrospect? And maybe you could say there's some qualities like complete spaciousness, not the kind of space that that's the object of shamatha, but complete spaciousness. We could say complete relaxation, even if your body is like in total pain, because it's kind of like dropping off body and mind. And there's still awareness. There's still like the body is part of it. It's not like nothing's happening. So everything is included, and yet nothing hinders it. And it's very bright and very, very radiant and alive. And none of those words actually reach it. And maybe to pause for a moment, say like, so what's the point of all this anyway? So what? And why bother? Because it's a big project. I think this kind of practice is hard work. Why bother? And apart from this list, oh, by the way, in case I forget, I left a handout, it's maybe back there, turning the light and shining back. So this is like very pith instructions from like 20 different Buddhas and ancestors, almost all Zen, but I threw in some Tibetan ones saying the exact same thing, and a Taoist one for Richard, very specific, very same Taoist and Chan kind of mixed. Secret of the Golden Flower is all about this practice. So we might say, well, they all say that this is like the essential thing. So if we just have faith in that, but we might say, but still why? And I think because it's not about just like sitting in that space. It's about living more and more from that space where, because that space, we could say, confirms that everything is included and nothing's outside, and there's no separation. There's no separation. And we need to, like, we've heard it a million times, but we need to, like, confirm this in any way we can over and over again. All these Zen and Dzogchen both really emphasize more and more subtlety in how this then is brought into the world. It's not just something that you do in the lab of Sashin on the cushion. And this, you know, is quite challenging. It's all quite challenging. But how that's the point, I think we could say more and more, is like, and you can start to live from this place where you're not abiding in meditative equipoise, as some would call it, you're influenced by that, and you I think that transition between the meditative equipoise and the, you know, post meditation, which is called the rest of our life, is so it breaks down more and more, because that's a separation. It becomes revealed that that's not a real separation either. So it is, again, all about kindness and compassion and the way we live in the world harmoniously with others. But this is like in the lab. Back to the lab a little bit here. This is another nice one from Sogni Rinpoche. A nice image. When, if you are going to meet the Queen, like the Queen of England, like, you want to, like, be prepared for this. You want to, like, look your best. You want to get all ready, all, you know, adjust your clothing and comb your hair and be ready for this important meeting. So these are like the preparations. So the Queen of England here is the nature of mind, right? So you get ready in this like kind of like somewhat contrived ways, and you're giving yourself some instructions. You're taking care of all these things, like the relaxation, staying with the object, the vigilant, one with no tolerance, and that's creating shamatha. And then you're remembering in that space some of these pith instructions, like now, but wait, there's more. Turn back. And then that's when you're like, now we're about to meet the queen. Now, like, so, like, we're doing these fine-tuning adjustments. You know, just a little bit, like, how's my mudra? Relax. Upright, relax, out my heart. Getting okay here. You're like, queen. And then right at the moment of meeting the queen, there she is. Hello, so nice to meet you. You know, at that moment, we stop checking our hair and our clothes, actually, right? At the moment of meeting the queen, don't adjust anymore. I think this is a great image. Fine-tuning adjustments right up to the moment, and then don't meet, Rinpoche emphasizes, don't check. And this is, again, looking for a conceptual confirmation. Okay, is this it? That's like, yeah, that actually blocks it. Just dropping off body and mind, completely letting go, releasing, and falling back into it is another image. Turning the light around has this problem, like Nanette mentioned, and sometimes I've talked about like this, and I think this is kind of problematic. I'll try not to do this anymore. Because this is kind of implies like your awareness, it's just an image for your awareness is directed outwards and you're turning it back. But the problem here is that it becomes too conceptual, I think. It's not really that you turn your awareness back. And also, let me just finish this little part here. She said, then if I do that, I start to feel like then it's in my head. And Alan Wallace actually addressed this point. He said, somebody asked that, I think. They said, I feel like there's something like I'm looking for it subtly in my head, or I feel like my head's getting congested. And he said, if this happens, actually keep doing the same thing, or you're turning back here, but bring that, sense of what you're looking back at that's subtly located in the head. It feels like it's located here, and what we're looking for is something without location, but you can start with playing with the location. He said, bring it actually down into your heart. Yeah, that's what you're going to say?
Yeah.
He said, almost like it's a little technique that you're still, that's not quite it exactly, because that's another location, but it breaks up the head orientation and has a different energetic, the heart chakra, actually. I think he even talked about it as the chakra. And then from there, you can continue to actually open it up into your whole body. And I think Nanette said something like this. She's naturally discovered that of like, I like felt like my whole body is the one that's aware. And so he said almost something like that. But then still, I'd say still you could go further with this. It makes it more big, because we're looking for something very big, but so big it has no, so vast it is outside location. How is it? Something like that in the dual mirror samadhi. So it's like, you could then expand beyond your body to like the vast space. But then, you know, still then we have to see, is there some, are we still looking for some image, like space even, that's the source? So that's when it's the complete dropping off of all of it. Yeah.
Is source of mind or awareness dependent on the arisen?
No. I say. Because another name for this is Buddha nature, which doesn't come and go and is not dependent on any conditions. And this is a controversial topic, so maybe we should say it depends what school. of Buddhism. But I think maybe all of the Mahayana, actually, even the Madhyamakas that want to empty out everything, still would say this is Buddha nature is not dependently arisen. If this is the nature of mind, which is so radical, and why it's not a conditioned thing. If it were, then maybe we could see it and get a hold of it. But it's not. It's not a thing. And yet, it's not nothing, because it's radiant brightness. So.
But that was the one who, and of course Zen. That's why to me they're both the same. The one always contains the other. You know, has the seed of the other, and you know, and flows from the other. So there's never the thought of one thing existing without the other, absolute and phenomena, or yin and yang. You know.
But we could say, like, dependent co-arising, the ocean of the interdependent universe of arising and ceasing phenomena all working interdependently. You could say that is one with this empty nature.
It is. They contain each other. They have to. We wouldn't be here otherwise.
The relationship between those is extremely subtle, I think. And because if you say that the interdependent co-arising world of arising and ceasing phenomena is that dependent on Buddha nature, then you have a dependent relationship, and then you have to say, well, then Buddha nature depends on it, and then Buddha nature becomes conditioned or dependent. So it's quite tricky. It's, I think, a little bit, we could say this is like beyond conceptual words, but people have done a valiant job of getting pretty close, which is why I love hearing people who are like these many centuries of lab technicians who are trying to, like, how can we express this more and more clearly?
I gotta put this in. This is the lab technician business, you know? And this is something I don't know how many people have heard, and it's pretty recent, because I just heard it recently. And it was a neurophysiologist, I think, giving a TED talk, or it was, or some frontline kind of, that pretty strongly, foundationally, they have found that the same kind of neural spider web-like network that's involved with the thinking in the brain is found two other places in the body that can think. One is, they found it literally, that type of neural network around the heart and also in the gut. And so it's just,
yeah,
I love
gut.
When, you know, I mean, you get just these little confirmations of things, you know, but it opens that question of turning the light around. Well, one way, which you started right away, since I was thinking of it, you were answering it, is, well, you can stop trying to necessarily turn this around. You can move to here or to here to turn the light around. You can start looking from other parts of the body.
Yeah.
Or, of course, then assume the whole body.
Yeah, or the true human body, the entire universe in 10 directions is the true human body, which so expand infinitely, this body. I think it's good to remember that to keep separating brain and mind, and there may be some relationship between them. But these scientists are nice how they say, like, maybe there's some kind of thinking in the gut or the heart, and so putting it just gets us out of this locked version that this is all coming from the brain, because Buddha nature surely does not reside in the brain. Although there's maybe some debate in the science world. They don't have Buddha nature, right? But
but that's the point. The science world is starting to break
away
from that, you know.
Yeah, but what about not even in the body? Not even actually, this is, This is like that the body is a manifestation of this nature. And I just saw something about different near-death experiences, and that were like people trying to confirm that when the brain is completely flatline, there's some quite intense and incredibly joyful experiences happening to these many people. So this is cutting edge science, right? Of like, because you don't find that many near death experiences like in the moment with the people there to monitor them because they're trying to save their life. So, anyway, without getting too much into science, it's a vast, inconceivable universe, and this life is just an amazing gift that we can appreciate this, to stop and like appreciate this is so beyond our little day-to-day issues. Right? So Sashin's nice for that. And then we come back into our everyday issues with this perspective. Yes.
Suggestions from yesterday. I'm kind of off that have this humorous thought. It's like, why is the mind door feel so much bigger than any of the other sense doors? It's like a huge door. In my experience, it just tends to the conceptual mind tends to overpower hearing or seeing or other senses. But then it was kind of interesting to feel like, well, if that's true, then I understand in a lived way in my life, I actually have some data to help me calm down about when the stories are really unpleasant. It's like, oh, well, you know, your mind is really elaborating a lot. You know? So the world that I think I'm stepping into is actually, I have more information that part of it is like, don't take it so seriously.
Yeah.
I do think of it as in the brain, but.
It's a huge door that causes a lot of trouble when we take it too seriously. And has a lot of potential because it's such a huge door. But it's true, it's huge because you can only see to the horizon or within these walls, although through some of these practices people sometimes there's talk about people being able to see further than the walls. But because I think these things are related. But generally the senses are somewhat limited, whereas the mind, you can think about when you were in Australia a year ago and be there in your mind. That's a huge door, for example, and so many, you know, because it's so big, it's like hard to work with it, and there's some out of control aspects, like we like grip onto a problem and really start reifying it and we cause ourselves so much suffering, a little suffering through the other sense doors, but a huge suffering through the mind door, and little liberation through the sense doors, huge liberation through the mind door. So, another oral instruction from Sobmi Rinpoche. Specifically we were talking about like turning the light around back like this, and he said, I think he even did something like, not like this. Now that I recall, I think he. Because that's too rough or something. And his image, which I think is kind of helpful, is like, it's like a camera lens, like maybe a telephoto lens, that where you turn it and it goes in and out. So it's usually outward directed, and it's turning the lens so it retracts inward. So that has this visual image of retracting inwards, but also that makes the wider angle, right? I think that's the way the lenses work. When it comes in, it's a wider angle. So again, these are just metaphors and images to play with this subtle technique, but we're directed outwards. In Zazen, imagine like withdrawing your lens more and more. It gets wider and wider, and then maybe I would even add in, it gets so wide that it actually like flips behind you, and that's when you fall back in to the source of the camera. So I think that's actually quite a bit more helpful than because it's wider, it's expansive, it's letting go, it's less graspable. You're not pointing directly at some point. And then it's really like it's a letting go. Another thing he said was, the mind that's looking and the looked at source actually can't really be separated. They're not really, it's not really, there's awareness that's in, and it's looking back at the source. That's just a way of talking. Actually, the sutra says something almost identical to that too. But, it's not that they're really separated in, it's, a, and in the act, but it's a technique that you're playing with this sense of the, how they're separated. And in the act of looking back and completely letting go, that's when, the dualistic mind dissolves, or the looker dissolves into the looked at. Yeah. So, just to. One of the points on this, they're all saying almost the same thing, and they're all saying, that this is very important. And so here's one that's more detailed of these, of the Zen ancestors about this. Long Shi Dao Long in the 1200s, so lived at the same time as Dogen. And I think he's a Chinese teacher that came to Japan, living the same time as Dogen. Rinzai, I think. What is turning the light around and shining back? Echo Hensho. Illuminating outward things, one's own light is turned back to shine on the inner self. The knowing mind is the light. So the mind that knows things is the light we're talking about. Errant thoughts are shadows. So discursive thoughts are like, kind of blurry shadows that the light of awareness is not so clear about. It's murky. The light illumining things is called shining. And when the mind and thoughts do not range over things, but are turned toward the original nature, this is called turning the light around and shining back. It's also called panoramic illumination, which is like that. Yep. Like that sense, panoramic illumination. I don't know what that is in Japanese. Illumining the whole of the immediate substance. It's where neither delusion nor enlightenment have ever appeared. In Buddha nature, there's no delusion and no enlightenment. And no coming and going, no here or there in between. The non-production of a single thought is what is known as the original essence of mind, or original nature of mind. It's not stopping thought, yet it's also not stopping thought. It's just the non-production of a single thought. The Zen-like saying, yeah.
Is that like a statement going beyond enlightenment?
Yeah. Yeah, going beyond enlightenment. Is that in the Jijyu Zamai? Yeah, going beyond enlightenment. Or maybe it was in the Fukan Zengi this morning. Something like freedom, enlightenment, and non-enlightenment, something like that. And dying while either sitting or standing have all depended entirely on the strength of Zazen. going beyond enlightenment and non-enlightenment, maybe. Yeah. So, because those are like anything we can possibly think about, enlightenment is a conceptual idea. Not to mention delusion. And, yeah, in the Ajo's absorption in the womb of light, the treasury of light, is also on here. Just a Kōen Ajo is Dogen's disciple. There's actually, and there's three places, there's even more places where Dogen uses Echo Henjo, but with the aid of computer searches, we can find all of them. You plug in the characters. And I put the ones that I feel like are really talking about this very clearly on in this handout. Ejo, his student, says, just cast body and mind into the great treasury of light and don't look back. And I think that he means, we've been using look back, but I think he means don't think about the past anymore. Or don't check and assess like how you got here or any of that. Cast body and mind, drop body and mind, fall back into the great treasury of light and don't look back. And then he says in this beautiful essay called Absorption in the Treasury of Light, he says, this light is not more in Buddhas or less in deluded sentient beings. It's not, and upon enlightenment, it doesn't increase. And when totally wrapped up in confusion, it doesn't decrease. It doesn't come or go. It's not, and I think he says, and when you're born, it's not born with you. And when you die, it doesn't die with you. That's why it's not a dependently co-arisen thing. And, you know, it's a little controversial because people say, oh, wait a second. What kind of thing is that? Mm-hmm. Sounds like the grand Atman, some essential eternal self. But it's completely empty of any, so talking about the qualities, if your lab technician wants to check on it afterwards, one of the, on the checklist is there anything there to conceptually get even the slightest hold on, touch at all? Are there any reference points? Like, it's vast, even that's a reference point. It's bright. Is it really bright? And that's a reference point. And yet, it's not nothing. Nothing's actually a reference point too. So, Sashin's a great gift too. You know, we might be like, well, this all sounds too complicated. And but one of the teachings about this is that it's always here with us. Whether we feel like, I have no idea what this is all about, and like, this is, you know, something completely outside my experience. Actually, it's not. It is your experience. It's the source of every mind moment. And therefore, we've been talking about the subtlety of this, and yet it could be spoken of in very, very ordinary ways too. Like, it's just like right now we're thinking and talking and looking, and behind, you know, all this is coming from this empty source. It's just that if we're not really still, it's like, it's so easy to get some idea of that. And like, oh yeah, I kind of have a sense of that. It's like, it's, we're making it into an image or something. Also the mirror, we won't get into the mirror this week, but exactly the same practice. This is just a different method called turning the light around. But being the mirror, as opposed to the reflections on it, as opposed to getting, like, working out the reflections on it, is the same thing. So it's woven through the whole Zen tradition over and over in many ways.
Thinking, non-thinking?
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. Think, and it particularly as Thomas Cleary, who is a great fan of this turning the light around, shining back, he wanted to make this point, but he, you know, is amazing Chinese-Japanese language expert, as we know, so he's got a kind of a detailed footnote that says, actually, you know, look, the grammar of this sentence, think of not thinking, is really the way it's set up in Japanese, really, it's most appropriate to read it as not thinking is really the object of the sentence. So I think thinking of not thinking, but he puts it even more explicitly as thinking of what doesn't think, or thinking of that which doesn't think. So which is a little different than some people's understanding. And I don't think there's any right or wrong, because it's be interpreted, Dogen can be interpreted in infinite ways. But one version that is often non-thinking is the mind that includes both thinking and not thinking. And maybe that's not actually different, because that's true, right? But this is more like he's really making the point that this is a specific exercise. Yeah, thinking of that which doesn't think is turning the light around and shining back, which Dogen, you know, mentions both of those in the Fukan Zazengi as the essential art of Zazen. He also says, put aside the intellectual practice of pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns the light around to shine it back. So it's that kind of shamatha instruction. First of all, don't do this in some like really conceptualized way. It has to become, it's, the instructions are conceptual, but then at the time of actually practicing, put all of discursiveness aside, and body and mind of themselves will drop away. Yeah. Original face. It has no eyes and ears and nose and tongue sticking out of it. Will manifest. May all beings who've become completely wrapped up in the appearances of dualistic mind and objects as the setup promotes, setup of human life promotes. May the positive energy generated here bless all these suffering beings, including ourselves, so we can let go and drop off, release, and love this world. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.